Now, of course, now you got bullpens out in the outfield. Now, I imagine you have a phone, right? A phone that's connected in the dugout?
Yeah, every bullpen has a phone, and it has to have a phone now. You know, they've standardized all those because the communication you have to have. And if the phone's down, you got to let the umpire know, and you got to get another way to communicate with them, whether it's a walkie-talkie or something like that. And the other thing a lot of the bullpens have now where you can't see the bullpen is you have monitors. So if I can't visibly see the bullpen from the dugout, you know, I want to be able to look up in the outfield and see if they got a lefty up or a righty up, because you're deciding on your pinch hitter, because your decision enters in. If they have nobody up, you say, hey, I might sneak this lefty in. They're not going to bring the lefty in. He hasn't been warming up. So you let the guy on deck go out, and at the last minute, you call him back. If you show your hand, you're going to pinch hit the lefty. They may get a guy up real quick. So most of the bullpens where you can't see, most of the dugouts where you can't see the bullpen, there's monitors in there to show you who's warming up so you know exactly what's going on.
Well, you know, it's funny. In baseball, some of the best stories involve bullpen phones. And Mo Drabowski, who pitched for the Orioles, the Cubs, Kansas City, he had kicked around, a very effective right-handed pitcher. But he was a character. And when he was with the Orioles, he used to use the bullpen phone in the dugout or in the bullpen, and he would call the other bullpen. And he'd make believe he was the bullpen, you know, coach. And he'd say, get Lasky up. And Lasky would start throwing, and they'd sit in the dugout and say, why is he throwing now? And he did this for many, many times until they caught on that it was Mo Drabowski doing it. How about that?
That's great. That's a lot of fun. You know, that's the way the game used to be, huh, Bill? As you mentioned, there was a lot of things that you could get away with, and all in good fun, and it's the stuff that happens behind the scenes, but you don't see much of that happen today. There's so many cameras and video cameras on everybody. A lot of that stuff is gone today.
Hey, Bert Blyleven used to crawl under the stands to give somebody a hot foot.
I heard that one before.
Remember that?
Yeah, I have heard. The hot foots are always notorious with people climbing behind a hole behind the dugouts back in the day, and the hot foot was always the fun ones, but you better be winning when you do that, because if you're horsing around and you're getting your tail beat, I think you better run for cover if the manager finds it. But, you know, going back to all the little phone things like you just mentioned, Marty, I can imagine there was more of that, but nobody really got caught doing it. You might have got away with it once or twice, but to come out and tell that, I think that would be sensational to start messing with the other bullpen that way.
Yeah, I'm surprised no one tries it now, because you probably can tap into the phone, right? Well, you probably get the number of the opposing bullpen.
I don't know if you can call. You know, I've never tried, you know, but you're giving me something to do this year.
Yeah.
I might see if we can get back playing. I'm going to give it a go. But, you know, I will tell you this, being a utility, you know, infielder at the end of my career after I was in the big leagues and back in AAA, you know, one of the jokes we used to play on each other, and Bill, I don't know if you ever had this happen to you, is you would get a cup of water, you know, from the Gatorade thing. It's a small cup of water, and you chew some gum. And, of course, if you're a utility player, you're on the bench watch, and you have all the time in the world to, you know, watch for people, set up who you're going to get. So you chew the gum, and you get the gum to the right consistency. So it'll stick for a little bit, and maybe in about 10 seconds, it won't hold. And what you do when a guy sits down, you get behind him or up above him somehow. You take the gum onto the cup, you stick it up to the top of the dugout, and then you move away, right? You go get some water or do something. And about 10 seconds later, that cup of water falls on the guy, and he's looking around. He doesn't know who it is. And that's the kind of fun. That's the kind of fun we like to have. And you really felt good when you get a guy and he didn't know who did it.
Would you do that, Will? Did you ever do that to anybody?
Oh, yeah. I did it a lot in the minor leagues. In the big leagues, I wasn't privy to do anything like that. They would have sent me back to AAA. I hadn't been around long enough. But in AAA, I spent a few days down there, and we had some fun.
That's true, Ron. The minor leagues, you did more game playing and setting up people and different things like that. And I just think that part of the game also has kind of disappeared. And that was really the minor leagues, when you're on those long bus rides and you come in and you just want to prank the other guy or have some laughs, you know, kind of loosen up the gang. And those are all different things that every minor leaguer did back in the day. And it was just, and if you didn't laugh about it, you were going to get drilled for the next 2 weeks. You had to just kind of let it go, be the snap guy. Okay, all right, I get it, all right. But yeah, you know what I'm saying, Rod. If you don't take it, you get mad and upset, oh, you're a target then.
You're exactly right.
I love it. Hey, Mike McCormick, his name got in the this day in baseball history. He was a terrific left-hander for the San Francisco Giants. He was a bonus baby, guys, back in the mid-50s. He was signed by the New York Giants, and he was a tremendous, tremendous high school pitcher. And they used to have the Journal American game in New York, an all-star game, and he went back and was amazing there, and the New York Giants signed him. Horace Stoneham signed him. Well, he pitched a five-inning no-hitter as a San Francisco Giant against the Phillies, and he got to the sixth inning, and he gave up a hit. And then the rains came and rained the game out, so it went back to five innings. The Giants won the game 1-0, and he got credited for a no-hitter. Now, this stayed in the books until 1991, and then baseball said, well, if you don't complete the game, or if it's anything short than nine innings, you don't get credited for a no-hitter, even if you go 10-plus innings or so as a no-hit game. And I was thinking about Mike McCormick because I got to meet him. And as I say, he was 17 years old when he first got up to the big leagues. And I think they had him room with the trainer or something. Nobody wanted a room with the guy because he was only a teenager. But did you guys know Mike McCormick at all, the lefty?
Go ahead, Bill. I'm sure you have more experience with Mike than I did.
I do. And a very good friend of mine. Of course, he came to fantasy camp for so many years. Just a stellar type guy. Just a stand-up guy. Told stories all about his childhood. As you said, Marty, when he came up, he was a young left-handed pitcher and literally was scared. I mean, they brought him right to the big leagues as a big bonus baby. And he pitched for the New York Giants back then. And, of course, he was the only Cy Young winner the Giants had for the longest time until Tim Lincecum won his first and then won his second. But Mike is struggling, 80 years old. He's got Parkinson's now. I talked to him once in a great while. It's difficult for him right now. But just a great Giant, just a great ambassador for the game and one of the nicest human beings you'd ever meet.
Yeah, I got to meet him at the ballpark and at fantasy camp, and just a sweet guy. But, this is one of those 17-year-olds. Can you imagine this, 17 years old in the mid-50s, and you had to stay in the big league roster for 2 years if you were a bonus baby. And we've talked about Joey Malfitano and those stories. And here he was. Nobody wanted a room with him, and he's in the big leagues as a 17-year-old.
Wow, that's simply amazing. I mean, you see it in other sports, right? You see guys come out of college in football. Obviously, that's where they come out of. And, you know, there's been a few guys come out of high school to play professional basketball. But baseball, I mean, you know, to come out of high school and be that young and to play at that level, I mean, you learn so much in the minor leagues. I mean, I know I did. I wasn't even close to thinking about playing major league baseball when I was out of high school. No way, Bill. I don't know how you feel. It is just simply amazing that a guy can make that jump. And you know, I've said hello to Mike many times at the ballpark for events that we have there, and you know, when they have reunions and things, and was always a pleasure to talk to. A well-spoken, you know, quiet guy, very, very humble. And yeah, I'm glad we got a chance to talk about him. I didn't know he was had Parkinson's, so thanks for sharing that with us, Bill.
Yeah, you know, Ron, there was a handful of guys in the 60s, 50s, that went right from high school to the big leagues. The first guy that I ever remembered even going through college and then going right to the big leagues was Bob Horner. And the pressure he had, I remember when he was at Atlanta, the pressure was on Sports Illustrated cover, all this stuff. So just think, a kid coming out of high school and thrown into the big leagues, that had to have been just an eye-opening experience. And Mike handled it very well.
Yeah, he did. And
wow.
He was a Giant in 62, the year they went to the World Series, and coming back on the plane from one of the games, Horace Stoneham said, well, it's been a pleasure having you here. Wherever you are next year, good luck. And he knew he was being traded, and he got traded to the Orioles that winter. He always tells that story. But you talk about high school pitcher, and it's funny because it's the draft, and every, you know, you talk about all the scouting reports. Everybody sounds like the next, you know, Juan Marichal or Lincecum.
Mm-hmm.
But David Clyde, came out of high school and went, guy pitched in the big leagues. You know, he graduated high school in June 15th and June 19th. He was pitching in Texas. Mike Morgan, remember how many years he pitched in the big leagues, a right-hander? Charlie Finley did that with him. And I think Tim Conroy, I don't know if you guys knew Tim. He ended up being a scout with Atlanta and Kansas City. So it's happened before where the high school kid goes right to the big leagues. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, well, you mentioned most of those guys were pitchers, which I think, you know, if you have the stuff, it's a little easier to do than to go from high school hitting to hitting major league pitchers. Yeah. My goodness. And, you know, so that was, you know, Bob Horner was one guy I remember. But the one pitcher that I think made the jump, too, that was outstanding, you guys both remember him. You may not have seen him pitch, and that was, he was a great pitcher. His name was Sid Finch. With the Mets. Remember the infamous Sid Finch? What was that? There was a mock story about a great pitcher. I don't remember the details on it, but I think it was all a farce, wasn't it?
Yeah, we'll have Jay Horowitz on, the PR guy from the Mets, one of these days. He'll tell the Sid Finch story. It was all fictitious, you know, and that's built. Yeah, Doug Greenwald sent me a text that said, don't forget about Joe Nuxall. And, of course, he was the youngest to ever pitch in the big leagues, and this happened in 1944. He was 15 years old, and there was a shortage of manpower in those days because of World War II. And the Reds came to scout his father, Orville, they were scouting Orville, and then they saw the kid pitch, Joe Nuxall, who was still in junior high. He was 15, and they said, boy, the kid's better than Orville. And they signed Joe Nuxall, and he pitched in the big leagues at 15 years, 9 months, whatever. And they brought him in the ninth inning, and he got an out, and that was the last out he got. And he didn't come back to the big leagues for 8 years. And then he ended up having like a 12, 14-year career. So I like that story, too. You guys ever meet Joe Nuxall? He was a broadcaster for the Reds.
I'm trying to remember because I think he was there when I was in the 80s. He might have been there. The name sounds very familiar. Of course, I know the name from baseball world, but I just can't picture it. And, you know, sometimes you get to talk to a lot of those announcers when they're behind home plate, and other times you just kind of, you know, have their way because they're usually talking to the coaching staff or the manager of the team you're playing for.
Yeah, Sam Spear just texted in and said, don't forget about Al Kaline, too. So,
you knew I knew that one.
That was coming. Hey, ESPN's going to do something tomorrow night about McGuire and Sosa, the home run race of 1998. And who knows, with everything that's going on in baseball, we may need some story here to spark some interest, which actually I'm going to digress for a second and say if it is a 48 or 50-game season, anybody can win. Anybody can go to the World Series in 50 games. Maybe that'll be the hook of what gets everybody interested if the health is okay and baseball actually gets back on. So I just want to throw that in. I was thinking about it. But 1998, Woe and Bill, McGuire, Sosa, 70 home runs, 66. And, of course, you know, with the steroids and the PEDs and everything that's come out afterwards. But baseball needed it. It was an interesting thing for the fans. They loved it, and now there's going to be a big story on it. So I thought I'd just throw it out to you guys, what you remember about McGuire and Sosa in 98. Well, you can start with that one.
Yeah, well, I saw McGuire when I was managing in the minor leagues. He was in Tacoma, and, you know, he didn't look anything like he did in 98 and his following years in the big leagues. I mean, he was a good hitter, but he wasn't hitting for that kind of power. I mean, Tacoma is hard to drive the ball anyways, but he hit the ball hard. But I was all in on that home run chase. It was my first year in the big leagues. I was so excited to not be in the minor leagues, and to be coaching in the major leagues, and to watch these two guys go head-to-head. The coverage they had, I remember, you know, watching it every night, you know, where they're at. It was an exciting time for me, and I think baseball loved it. I think the fans loved it. And, you know, there's great memories of watching those guys. I thought it was great for baseball, you know, regardless of all the, you know, the steroid talk and all that. They went through it, and it was exciting to me, Bill. I don't know how you feel about it.
Oh, I was right there, too. I was finding out where they were playing, when we, and who was the pitcher, who was pitching against them. And when I remember this, I remember the commercial with Tom Glavine and Greg Maddux, and they were playing catch. and all the girls were screaming at McGuire, "Hey, what?" And Tom Glavin looks over to Maddox. He goes, "Yeah, chicks like the long ball." You remember that commercial? It was one of the
great ones. Yeah,
that's the first thing. But I was right there with you, Ron, watching all that too. I was a fan.
Last thing I'll say, Marty, real quick, if I could, is the one thing that stood out when McGuire, you know, after he did that, he was a player, which people did this with Bonds as well, and I didn't do it with Sosa, but you'd go down early to the bench when you played when he was with the Cardinals, and you'd watch him take batting practice because how far he was hitting the ball. And I did it myself. We'd go into St. Louis, and I didn't want to miss his batting practice because he was hitting them up there in Big Mac land, and he was shrinking the ballpark. It was something to see.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Vladimir Guerrero was like that for me, too, to watch him take BP. But what about Sosa? You know, he gets absolutely no consideration, of course, with the PEDs and everything else for the Hall of Fame. That's going to knock him out. But what about Sosa, Woe, dealing with him as a player in the game and everything? What kind of player was Sosa?
Well, he was a very dangerous hitter. Obviously, he was hitting all those home runs. You know, we didn't play them that much. Him being with the Cubs for the majority of his career, I believe we only saw him, you know, 3 or 6 games a year. You know, obviously Dusty, you know, left the Giants. He had Barry Bonds to deal with, and he went to the Cubs, and Bake was the right guy to handle that big ego and that mega star and Sammy Sosa. And I remember talking to Bake quite a bit about him, and I thought he did a great job with him. But he was a personality. I think he had his own BP thrower. He had his own strength coach or hitting coach. You know, that was a time in the game when it was getting close where, you know, players were starting to have their own people come in and override, you know, the coaching staffs. And Major League Baseball had to do something about that. Of course, the steroid era and allowing certain people to come in the clubhouse. Well, I'm getting off track here, but, you know, I didn't know Sosa very well. Just dealing with him, I mean, he was a guy that you didn't want to let beat you. I mean, he was that good and that dangerous, and you'd walk him if the game was on the line because he was that good of a hitter.
Yeah.
Boy, I tell you what, Ron, Chicago loved him. And we always watched him in Wrigley Field. The right field bleachers would applaud him, and he'd always bring the American flag out there running out there. He was that Latin flavor type of player, you know, look at me kind of guy, but I thought he was a very above-average player. I really did. I really liked him. And with all the PEDs and hitting all their home runs, and don't forget about the cork bat when he broke it. The cork came out and on the infield, and he blamed somebody else on the team. And then they grabbed the bat and ran it up, and they tried to hide it. You know, that whole story comes up to me about Sammy Sosa. But, you know, that going back to Sosa and McGuire, though, as you said about the batting practices, they had to have just lit up the board for batting practice. The way they hit the ball and hit it so high, and those home runs were so far, and just a good time of baseball for fans in that whole era.
Well, I told you, Art Howe told me the story that when the Pirates took – well, I may have said this during one of our Sunday shows. When the Pirates took batting practice, when Art was there with the lumber company and all that, they had different baseballs for batting practice. They would bring out a different ball. So these guys just – Stargell and Parker and all these guys, Al Oliver, just crush the ball. And the other team would just sit there with their mouths open.
Wow. I didn't know that. You know, playing for the Pirates, they certainly didn't have that ball when I was taking batting practice. I couldn't get it out of the infield, for crying out loud. They probably used a softer ball when I hit.
Very good. Hey, 98, though, for the Giants. And, of course, you're just up in the big leagues. An interesting year. You have to fight to get into a playoff game with the Cubs, believe it or not, and you have to face Steve Traxel, who always gave the Giants trouble. He pitched so slowly. And Mark Gardner was on the hill, and the Cubs win the game 5-3. But you lose on Sunday, excruciating kind of game, and Duane talks about this all the time. The Nephi Perez home run in the bottom of the ninth beat you, and you had a 7-0 lead. You win that game, you wouldn't have had a playoff with the Cubs. And I'm sure you remember it. I'll just bring it up gently.
Yeah, well, I remember both. Obviously, the Cub playoff game, you know, that we had to go there was just a magnificent night. You know, they had the Harry Carey balloon out there. It was packed. The atmosphere was a gorgeous night. It wasn't much of a game. Traxel shut us down. I was coaching third in the game. We didn't put much together, and I remember that very well. It was great atmosphere my first year in the big leagues in that playoff game. But the night before, or two nights before, as you said, it might have been the night before because we had to go play that one-game playoff. So I think we had to travel to Chicago that night, the day game in Colorado. We had a 7-0 lead, and that's when they had Castillo, Walker, and who was in Bichette. And we had a 7-0 lead going into the seventh inning or sixth inning. And they hit 2 3-run homers, just big bombs. And here we go. We have a 1-run lead in the game. And we were getting our relievers would run down from the clubhouse telling us about the Cubs game on what was going on. Mm-hmm. Because if the Cubs lost and we lost, we were still going. Mm-hmm. And I think Brant Brown in that game, the Cubs I think they were winning the game, and he dropped the fly ball, I think, that caused them to lose the game. And then there was the ninth inning for us. We had Rob then on the mound, so we were all excited. All we had to do was get through the ninth inning. And one of our relievers runs down, and he said, "The Cubs lost. And now if we win, you know, we're winning the division." Mm-hmm. And no sooner than he said, "The Cubs lost," it was 5 seconds. Then throws a slider down and in to Nefi Perez, and he yanks one into the right field seats right down the line. And our hearts, we were so happy for 10 seconds, and then we were just miserable for the rest of the night going to Chicago. Wow. Yep, wow. That was quite a moment.
He was a Giant, wasn't he, Nefi Perez, at some point?
Yes, he was. Matter of fact, he certainly was, and he could really pick it. I managed against him in the minor leagues coming up with Colorado, and he was a nice player. He had some good years. I mean, he was a defensive guy more than his bat, but he could run into one, and he sure did against us. Down and in, it was his hot spot.
Yeah, and Ron, I remember that because he, like, golfed it out. And, you know, of course, the lefties, they like that ball down and in, and he didn't really hit it all that good. He hit it right down the right field line, but it was just the way Nen threw it. Nice slider down and in, and he just – really just knuckled it up off the top of the bat and went out. And everybody, every Giant fan was like, "Nelfi Perez, no way." You know?
Now, Dwayne gave Dwayne nightmares. He still talks about that. You know,
it's like the Bucky Dent home run against the Red Sox. It's kind of the same deal, right? Bucky Dent, come on. You kidding me? Nelfi Perez?
Oh, boy. And that's baseball. See, that's what we miss. You know, honestly, these guys, you know, look, I'm not going to get political on the thing, but that's what baseball is all about, these kind of moments to bring people back that you remember forever. And baseball's got to realize it. They've just got to come to grips with it and understand it. So I won't make a statement, but that's my feeling about it. Hey, we've got a couple of players to talk about, so we'll take a break. Reggie Sanders. And anxious to hear your thoughts about him. And then a lefty, pretty tough guy, too. Alan Embry pitched a lot for the Giants. So let's spotlight a couple of former players tonight. And also, it's the anniversary of the first interleague game. So we'll get some of your thoughts on that. And we'll do that and more with Ron Wotus and Bill Lasky right after this.